Hey guys, Garrett Exner from Veterans on Duty. As you know, we started a new video series, Beyond the Call. We're interviewing veterans and getting their take on the policy discussions and debates that are impacting the veteran community, impacting the country broadly across the nation. We got a special guest today for our discussion. It's Lee Wolf, the executive producer of the Ruthless podcast. We're here on set. It's an exciting interview. He's got a great backstory, growing up in California, two tours in Afghanistan, and then getting involved in Republican politics. Stay tuned for some great things. Lee Wolf, producer of the Ruthless podcast, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's
awesome to have you here. I'll say this up front. This is not the first time we've worked together on something.
We were
colleagues years ago in the Cruz office, and I got to say, that was a rock star team with the group of people that were in there. Aaron McGuire, Steve Guest, you all going on to amazing things, really churning them out. I'm probably bringing the Cruz average down a bit in success afterwards, but thank you so much for joining us today. Producer of the Ruthless podcast, Marine vet, two deployments to Afghanistan. But the thing that I got to get into right off the bat is the kind of arc or the narrative of your story. Kid from California, goes to San Francisco State, joins the Marine Corps, does two deployments to Afghanistan, gets into videography, photography, digital production, works at the RNC, Senator Cruz, and now you're here at arguably one of the most influential political podcasts in the country. How does the kid from California come to conservative podcasting like Ruthless? How does that arc happen?
It starts very early. I remember being out on a street corner as a very young man in 2004 with my father, and we were on one side. We had George Bush, Dick Cheney signs, and the other side had Gore Lieberman signs. And I didn't fully understand it, but I knew that there was this big contested election, and it was close, and nobody was sure who won. And my dad felt compelled to go out to this protest in our local community. And of course, we had the signs that said, like, sore loserman. And back then, if you can believe it, the insults were incredibly tame. I mean, these were, you know, people from your church were on one side and you'd be on the other. So it was like, oh, you know, your guy's no good. I don't know, your guy's just like a Norm MacDonald sketch. But that was kind of my beginning into politics of like, wow, this is actually stuff that really matters. Fast forward, I go to SF State, only school I applied to. They had a great broadcasting program. And I really wanted to be a sports center anchor. But as fate would have it, there was another Bush election right when I started school, and that one was not quite as contested as the first one, and the left on campus was furious about it. So we were out there tabling the next day with the college Republicans, and this group of Palestinians, same people that keep showing up over and over again, came after us, started throwing bottles at us, rocks, all that kind of thing, and I'm like, oh my God, this is... I got to be involved with this because whatever we're doing here, it's pissing off all the right people, you know? So that kind of became the basis of my activism and my advocacy, which I view my military service as an extension of that same advocacy and activism on behalf of the country, the republic, my community. So it seems weird that you would go from college activist to Marine Corps back to conservative media. But if you run the through line, mm-hmm. of advocacy and activism, it's all, you know, kind of roughly in the same lane.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you, you know, we're a veterans organization. We're very focused on the threats that face America. I'd love to hear about your two deployments to Afghanistan. How did those go for you? And if you could, maybe what are the biggest lessons learned that you're able to apply now in your continued activism?
I went to Afghanistan for the first time in 2012 with 1st MSB out of Camp Pendleton. And boy, was I not ready. And I think anyone who has been a second lieutenant going on a deployment to Afghanistan will agree that it doesn't matter your MOS, it doesn't matter your training. Getting to Afghanistan as a second lieutenant is very daunting.
How old were you?
Oh, man. don't ask me that. I was probably 23.
Okay.
By the time we actually got boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. I got promoted to first lieutenant within a week of being in Afghanistan. But at that, you know how this goes with the ranks. It doesn't matter because everyone you're with knows you as a second lieutenant. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter if you get promoted to first lieutenant, you're still a boot in their eyes. So I spent the whole deployment as a boot And I learned a lot, made a lot of mistakes for sure. One of them was, you know, as an example, for some reason, because I was the platoon commander of the MP platoon, which was a huge platoon, it was 75 Marines, mm-hmm. we were deaded out to the Motor T platoons. So every time they went out, I'd give them a section. And in the genius of my battalion commander, they thought, oh, he's the security platoon. This is the lieutenant we need to certify on all of the ISR systems. I forget the name of it, but there's a robotic machine gun. I think it was called the Gunslinger. Mm-hmm. All these things have very cool names, by the way. So they gave me the drone, the Raven. And they said, okay, you're going to be our one Raven pilot in the entire battalion. And I thought, okay, well, that doesn't really make sense because, yes, I'm a platoon commander, but all these, my platoon has section leaders that are all staff NCOs, mm-hmm. and they're getting deaded out. So I ran missions, but not nearly as many as these guys. Long story short, we get about 4 months into the deployment, and the battalion, I do a presentation of all this equipment. You know those goofy dog and pony shows they do, where they run you around all the different companies in the battalion, and oh, this med does this, Motor T does this, whatever. And they had me present all this gear that looked cool that nobody was using because I was the only one that was certified to use it. And the battalion commander says, you know, Wolf, I want to see that Raven fly. I'm like, okay. Bit of an odd request, but sure, why not? And then I thought about it, and I went to my company commander, and I said, sir, I haven't flown this thing in 6 months. I got certified at Pendleton. This is going to be a disaster. And technically, I'm not even supposed to, because you're supposed to recertify every 3 months. And he's like, look, just make him happy and do it. Long story short, what do you think happens?
I'm assuming you crashed this thing.
We lose the damn drone over fucking Marja. I'm panicking. Excuse me, freaking Marja. It's a family show. And I'm like panicking and I'm thinking like, this is not good. But I think it's okay though, because I told my company commander, I shouldn't be doing this. Mm-hmm. I wasn't recertified. There's no way they're going to fry me over this. But guess what happened?
Yeah, of course they did.
They tried. They didn't make it because I had good documentation. But I bring all that up to say it was a great lesson for me that like your perceptions of institutions are not, may not always be what you think they were. Because when I went to boot camp, when I went to OCS, I had this grand vision of the Marine Corps, which is instilled in you in boot camp and OCS of honor, courage, commitment, all things at all times, right? Mm-hmm. Just immutable. And when I found out that in the case of this particular battalion commander, there was no honor, that was tough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a $20,000 drone, so who cares? But he felt embarrassed because he was on the mission, so he wanted to, you know, I think it's called a nip lock. Mm-hmm. Like, he wanted to do some paperwork on me that, like, oh, he lost his drone.
Non-punitive letter of caution.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And I thought, that's outrageous. Like, I specifically said, this is a bad idea, and you ignored me. But that was a lesson.
Non-punitive, but it is. But
yeah,
it does punish you.
It's like, oh, you're not in trouble, but really, good luck getting promoted kind of thing. They ended up not doing it, which was good, but it was a lesson I took with me. One, that, you know, meet people and know people before you trust people, even in the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. which is unfortunate, but it's just the reality. But also, don't do that to your own subordinates. Mm-hmm. If you ask for something and they do what you ask and it goes sideways, that's on you. That's on you. And you got to take responsibility for it. And then my second deployment was kind of like the redemption deployment as a senior first lieutenant with a deployment under my belt, again with a TS Motor T company, XO, CLB-6, unreal deployment. I mean, just the best time of my life. I mean, I got nothing but good things to say about them. Captain Shule, Gunny Boley, now Sergeant Major Boley, just a great team. And getting out of that deployment really felt like that's the Marine Corps I signed up to be in. So
it's amazing how much leadership kind of impacts an entire unit, right? One bad battalion commander, one bad sergeant major infect the entire unit going down. I'd also just say, you know, it sounds like what you described is this mentality of the buck stops here, like, you know, the buck stops with me. But oftentimes that's what we get from senior leaders is, no, the buck stops with you. I'm going to put, like, you're going to get in trouble for that, even though I'm the one that told you to do it.
Well, it's easy to say the buck stops with me. But then when the moment actually arrives where someone's got to shoulder the burden, mm-hmm. you find out real quick who means it and who's just sort of saying it during the safety brief. So.
Exactly. Well, I want to get into your work now at Ruthless. How do you think Ruthless is impacting the current policy debates, politics in the United States? And then maybe a secondary to this, how do you think it can impact the veteran community, what veterans want to see out of their military, their government, and all that?
Ruthless is unique. Ruthless does something that no other podcast can, and that is bring genuinely inside information from politics into a show talked about by people who not only understand the information, but can then contextualize it in the long arc of American politics. The fellas, as we refer to them here on the program, have vast experience in American politics, on the Hill, running campaigns. A lot of podcasts out there, they just don't have that information. They sort of pretend that they do, and they talk through a list of talking points. I mean, they just print them out, and it's from some think tank or whatever, and they just sort of read through them. But they've never run campaigns. They've never been on the Hill. They really don't understand what it is they're actually reading or why it matters. So the fellas are really able to blow through that. And yes, there are other podcasts that have inside information, but they're pretty boring. They'll give you an analysis from the professors, the think tankers, and it's very good information. And, you know, I listen to them, so I'm not trying to be tough on these guys. But
no games, right? No game show type feel to it. Yeah,
that's the thing is Ruthless is the seriousness you would get from a college professor with the entertainment value that you would find with someone like Rush Limbaugh from back in the day. And I think because of that, people are able to get a continual feed of really valuable, real information and insight while also being entertained along the way.
And how do you think that, you know, impacts the veteran community or can impact the veteran community and what they're looking to get out of, whether it's honesty, candor, right? Some entertainment, some of the more, fraternity-like conversation, perhaps. Is that what the veteran community stands to gain from a podcast like Ruthless?
Yeah, I think they bring the type of information. If you want to be a well-informed staff NCO, junior officer, company grade officer, even a senior officer, and you want to know what's happening in the world that dictates the policy under which you live, this is a great public service to you because, sure, people who are on active duty aren't necessarily out there, you know, protesting or knocking doors or what have you, but they're obviously very affected by what goes on at the White House on Capitol Hill. So if you want that insight into which direction the winds are blowing in terms of DOD policy, Navy policy, Marine Corps, Army, what have you, a show like this is very good because it equips you to sort of look around the corner a little bit in terms of where, you know, if you're a lifer, you're trying to do 30 years, you can kind of see where things are going. So
can I drill down on that for a second? You know, the things that are dictating the policy and the strategy that DOD is going to have to follow, what do you see as the kind of top priority that we need to be focusing on right now here in DC in the policy and political world?
They have to fix the esprit de corps problem. And people phrase that in different ways. You talk about woke. There's all kinds of different ways you can phrase it. But we all know in the veteran community and on active duty, the esprit de corps of the United States military was shattered into pieces under the last administration. We all got the phone calls. We all got the text messages. We're all in the chats and what have you from people on active duty telling us these stories of... and. Sure, some of it's very dramatic, but a lot of it's not that dramatic, but it is enough to put a crack in the esprit de corps. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, we all had to sit through this thing telling us we're terrible. Pick an example, right? And that has to be restored. We have to get back to what makes the military possible, which is you're not an individual. You're part of something larger than yourself. We have uniformity. We don't have all this goofy nonsense that people want to do with I'm this special type of person, so I get to do a different grooming standard. And, you know, I understand there's religious exceptions and that kind of thing, but a lot of the stuff that went on in the last 4 years basically set the military up to where we ended up with I don't know, I could probably show you half a dozen active duty officers. For some reason, a bunch of them are Army artillery. I don't know how that happened. But they're just, they're like political influencers on Twitter now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They got hot takes on Trump. They got hot takes on the Senate, Elon Musk. And, you know, the next post is them on their artillery training exercise. And the esprit de corps is gone. There's no consequences. You can do whatever you want. And a lot of these people just decided, I'm going to say and do things on social media that very clearly are toxic to good order and discipline. And I know there's not going to be any consequences because Biden's president and I'm saying the things that Biden agrees with, mm-hmm. And I'm going to get away with it. And so all that stuff rolled into one, I think, comes back to that piece of esprit de corps. And once we rebuild that, I think we can move forward. But there's just way too much nonsense.
During our time with Cruz, we had general officers criticizing journalists and sitting senators about policies for the United States military on Twitter, infected by some kind of woke influencers that kind of proliferated around DOD at different commands. How do you fix that? VOD is very focused on returning us to a strong, focused military. How do we fix that esprit de corps problem that you mentioned? Is it just firing the bad people, or is there something else we need to be doing?
The way you fix general officers, retired and active duty, making contemptible comments about the commander in chief is you send them to the brig. It's that simple. Deterrence is very powerful, and I won't speculate on why Mark Milley got a pardon, mm-hmm. But you know, if you folks out there want to fill in some blanks, saying contemptible things about the President of the United States is a chargeable offense, whether you're active duty or retired. And a lot of these people are subject to the UCMJ because of what they said and did. And there has to be consequences, firm, fair, just consequences for crimes that were committed, violations of the UCMJ. And I think that's a first step in restoring the esprit de corps and reminding everyone on active duty and retirees, you're subject to the UCMJ. We are not part of that world. You are not part of the political world. Mm-hmm. If you are in the active duty forces, or if you're in the case of retirees as well, you obviously have freedom of speech as a retiree, but you can still be recalled under Article 88. So, but for the active duty side, you're not political. If you want to have hot takes about politics, get out. That's it. Get out of the military. Go do your thing. I don't really care. But mm-hmm. while you're in, they have to be very aggressive about this and reminding the folks on active duty, you're here for that soldier to your left and right, that Marine to your left and right, those troops under your charge, and to fulfill the mission requirements that come to you from your leadership. You're not there to have hot takes. And that has got to stop.
100% agree. You mentioned a lot of issues internally to DOD. I'm like to switch to externally. Mm-hmm. What do you see as kind of the biggest threat facing the United States? The Intel community just released a report last week pointing most of the focus on China as the greatest threat to the United States. What's your take on kind of the threats that face America right now externally?
I am no expert in this field. I can only give you my personal views, but I'll preface everything I say with that. I am no college professor on these matters. I do get very nervous about how China operates. I think the inconspicuous nature of their strategy is very jarring for people who notice it. The Russians obviously are much more rambunctious. They just straight up invaded Ukraine. But the Chinese just slowly picking away at Tibet in the past, picking away at the South China Sea with the Spratly Islands, picking away at internal with the Uyghurs. They know exactly what they can get away with before somebody tries to stop them. And in the Philippines is another great example where they've very closely read the mutual defense agreement between the Philippines and the United States. And they know they can't use certain weapons when they're going after Philippine vessels, but they know they can use water cannons. Mm-hmm. So they're out there. If you haven't seen the footage, it's shocking, but they have extremely high power water cannons where they're just blasting away at these Philippine ships because they know that technically they're not firing mm-hmm. on those vessels. All of that's very disturbing because it's meant to do what it is doing, which is to keep the American people and most of the American government from really engaging in their activities. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of death by a thousand cuts. And we know the Chinese will not do something that they don't think they can get away with. So we need to start making it very clear what they cannot get away with and up the ante a little bit, in my opinion, in terms of maybe we look at that mutual defense pact with the Philippines and maybe we add the water cannons to that mutual mm-hmm. defense pact, things like that, where they now they know here's a new line and you cannot cross it. But it's really just jarring because it's so cloak and dagger. It's just they're so precise. They're mm-hmm. so their planning is so long term. I mean, it's just chip, 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 chip. And next thing you know, they have a $20 trillion economy. They have an enormous amount of influence over the South China Sea, and they're just openly running drills to invade Taiwan.
Mm-hmm. So, I gotta say that was probably the best expert analysis from someone who claims to be a non-expert. That was much better than, you know,
I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
If you were to interview 90% of the, you know, think tankers in DC, they'd probably give you a far less cogent answer than you just gave. That was exceptional. Particularly for a community that just wants, give me the straight talking points. What's going on? What's bad? What's good? And what do we need to do about it? Way better than most I've seen out here. In that context, internal problems at DOD, right? Esprit de Corps problems, external threats, China, Russia, Iran, others. What's the best advice you'd give to a young warfighter who's out on the forward edges of the empire right now, doing the work of the American taxpayer? What's the advice you'd give them?
Stay read up on the long arc, ignore the short-term noise. I think that it's very important, especially once you get to the rank of staff sergeant and higher and any officer, but really all ranks, to understand why you are where you're at. I didn't see until well into my first deployment the first Russian turret. Like they had these, they would build them out of stone. And mm-hmm. I saw one in Delaram. And it just washed over me like, this is not 29 poems. Like we're marching into the pages of history here for better or worse. And it might be worth taking a look at why I'm here, mm-hmm. you know? So I encourage anyone, particularly if you're really out there, you know, places like Djibouti or, even in Japan, Okinawa, there's a lot of history there that goes much, much deeper than the raising of the flag and that kind of thing. So learn why you're there, learn about the policies that put you there, but at the same time, don't get bogged down in the news cycle, don't get bogged down in the day-to-day. It's all noise. Mm-hmm. The things that will affect you take much longer to happen than one news cycle. So, you know, if you want to keep up on the news, that's fine, but you will get discouraged if you're standing post in Djibouti in 120 degree heat and then coming back and scrolling Twitter. Mm-hmm. Because you're just going to be like, what the hell are we defending here? This is insane.
Yeah.
But it's not real. The news cycle's not real. Twitter's not real. What's real is DOD policy, the long arc of American history, and kind of where we're trying to move this country strategically in all these different regions. So learn why you're there, but I wouldn't necessarily get involved in the debate of where we go next.
You mentioned earlier a story of a leader who let you down, disappointed you. Can you give us an example of a moment, a figure, a time from your service or after as a veteran that inspired you or continues to inspire you today? Some good news story here after
after talking about how China's taking over the world.
Yeah.
Thinking back, it seems small and I don't really have a big dramatic story, but there was a gentleman, Colonel John Solner, F-18 pilot. He was a Marine, and I met him at a time in my life where I was just considering joining the service, and it was at a party in San Francisco. He was probably 15 years older than me, probably old enough to be my dad, and I was chatting with this woman in the kitchen at this house party, and she's like, oh, you're thinking about joining the Marines. You have to meet my boyfriend. The guy didn't owe me anything. You know, he'd already served his time, and I was just this guy who wasn't even in yet, but he really just kind of took me under his wing and gave me really good advice on what to look out for and what to be ready for as I joined up. And, you know, it's not a super dramatic story, but he really did get me to where I am in the sense of he took a lot of the anxiety out of it, because before you know, boot camp is terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, you might as well take the ring to Mordor, have fun, you know, like it's the most daunting task you could imagine. And he took a lot of that away and enabled me to actually go. So Colonel Solner, if you're out there, I should call him. This is the world reminding me to give him a ring. Uh-huh. I really haven't chatted with him since before the pandemic. But just a very nice guy, and he took the time.
Yeah.
And the people that take the time really are the people that make a difference in our lives.
What made you want to join? What made you want to join the Marine Corps? Maybe the second part of that. And then a third part is, you know, why is the Marine Corps the best branch of service in the entire history of the world, for anyone who's
you're just teeing that one up, huh?
I have to do it. There's some Navy folks.
I'll try to get through this without getting emotional, but it is a little bit of a tough story. So, buddy of mine signed up for Iraq. I won't say his name because I just don't feel comfortable saying his name, but he got shot and killed by a sniper in 2007, and I was at another house party. One guess what I did in college. And they had the TV on. And on the news, his face came up. And they said, he killed in Iraq. And it just like, I'm like, holy, it's crazy. The whole, you know, the war came home, so to speak. And I just thought to myself, like, I'm doing absolutely nothing with my life. I'm at a okay college in San Francisco pursuing a degree I could probably get anywhere. And this war is going on. And it's not going to be going on forever. And I need to take part in it. Like, it's not, it didn't seem fair to me that, like, his family gave what they gave, and I didn't do anything. Mm. So, you know, that calling was very clear at that point, you know, that this is something you need to be a part of. If he's sacrificing, you need to at least sign up. And as far as joining the Marines, well, we both know the Marine Corps is the superior branch of the service, so it was not a hard choice. So it's obviously a tough story to tell. We all have stories like that that kind of get us a little emotional, but I'm glad I did it. You know, it was the right thing to do, and you know, just had to do it.
Can I get your pitch of why a young college student at San Francisco State or any other university, somebody in high school just about to graduate, why should they do it today?
Should I be blunt?
Yeah.
If you're in college right now, you're a much less capable human being than your parents and professors have led you to believe that you are. And that's not something people want to hear, because they want to be told, I'm smart, I'm genius, I know everything, but you really don't. And I was one of those people, which is how I know. And what the service did for me is really show me and remind me that I have a lot of development. I needed to humble myself. I needed to learn. I needed to listen. And I think if you're out there, you know, in college or in high school, when you're thinking about what the next steps are, try to step back and recognize that there's a lot of very good, very smart people out there who can turn you into a phenomenal person who operates in the world much more effectively than if you just sort of barrel roll through the standard college thing, which, not for everyone, but for a lot of people, is just nonstop adulation, reinforcement. You're great. Nothing you do is wrong. And the real world is just tough when you come through college that way, where you've never really had to deal with this type of adversity. But the military really turns you into a well-rounded person. Serving your country is extremely rewarding. I mean, even now in the shape I'm in, I'm still like, oh, I wonder if I could get back in. You know, like you're, I'm sure you have the same thoughts too. Like you still think like, I could probably squeeze in a few more. Like I'll do National Guard. You know, I'll do National Guard. So that's, I think, what it does for you. It makes you a much more well-rounded person who can kind of function in society. And it also makes you a lot less stressed. Mm-hmm. You know, like I see some of my coworkers out there, not here coworkers, but just in life in general, where they're like, oh no, this very inconsequential thing happened to me. What am I going to do? And it's like, who cares?
Yeah.
Once you do the service, I mean, you see these guys like hanging off the side of an aircraft carrier, painting it, you know, it's like, that seems pretty dangerous. That seems pretty stressful. Like not getting invited to the party seems a lot less stressful when you're going through the Red Sea getting shot at by Houthis. So
yeah, nobody's dying. We're just, you know, we're just filing some paperwork here in right. DC. So everything's fine. Well, the last thing we do, you know, typically here at VOD on you know, Beyond the Call is to ask our guests to bring a challenge coin. You've got one with you today. Just kind of tell us the story behind it and why it's important to you.
Yeah. So I think Nick has a graphic he can throw up of the coin itself. This was given to me by the Warriors Watch Riders, and I was not expecting it. The first time I came home from Afghanistan, the schedule got changed. There was snow, and it was very unceremonious. Flight landed, and I wasn't really expecting anything, and nothing happened. So I just kind of came home, and it was fine. But the second time I came home, they really pulled out all the stops. And these guys came in 1,000 strong, Harleys, Corvettes, sports cars, all kinds of cool stuff. And really, it was me and another guy, Menasini, and they greeted us at the airport. They drove us back to my house, and they had like the mayor there and all these people. And the back of the coin says, "Never again will an American warrior be scorned or ignored." And that hits you because these guys are Vietnam vets and they didn't get that. And really touched when I got this coin.
I think it's amazing how much the Vietnam vets have done for the global war on terror vets when, like you mentioned, not a lot was given to them when they came back. And I actually, you know, here at Veterans on Duty, and I hope many other veteran organizations will start taking the time to really recognize the Vietnam War generation and the sacrifices they made before we get to, you know, 10, 20 years from now when we realize, like we are now with the World War II generation, that there's not many of them left. I think, you know, your coin and your stories should be a call to action for veterans, right? For particularly global war and terror veterans, to do our part to recognize those guys who did so much for us. Well, with that, I'll leave it. Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, we got
us.
All the highs and lows, huh?
Yeah, right.
We got some laughs, we got some cries. It's all here for you.
A roller coaster of emotion in this interview. Thank you so much for joining
Absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely. Thank Great you. To have you
here. Here at Veterans on Duty, we are a policy advocacy organization focused on making sure our military is strong, lethal, and focused. All of that, of course, is about making sure America is safe, strong, and free. Those are the values that we hold dear, Vets on Duty, and that's why we're going to be sitting down with different leaders, veterans, policymakers, even some elected officials in our Beyond the Call video series. Stay tuned and join us.